What if we had an army of feminist bots? How much social structures are embedded in the code? Wireless was in the air.
Architecture is not so clear anymore.
We are at Rebirth FM at the recording studio in Akut in Berlin-Mitte today, and we're visiting Diana McCarthy, co-founder and editor of Rebirth FM. And Rebirth FM is a free artist radio which is streamed online, and it's also broadcasted. And we are very interested in your work, Diana, because with your radio program at Rebirth FM, you create spaces for people and communities in which those communities and people are able to share ideas and thoughts and information, different from how we approach this. You don't need to build houses for them to meet. We as architects always tend to focus on the physical space. And yeah, we would like to learn more about the media space that you create today.
Actually, we have a small quote between architecture and the spaces of radio, and it's written by Mark Wigley in his book Architecture in the Age of Radio. The nested spaces of radio we inhabit are infinitely more complex than the spaces of buildings. Our bodies still engage with physical objects, even encountering them as a kind of anchor or resistance against all the unseen flows, but the physical environment is much more intimately sensed and engaged by hidden signals, so closely and continuously that it is not an encounter between visible and invisible worlds, but a kind of symbiosis, a vibration between object and radiation. The distinction between them is no longer clear, which is to say that architecture is not so clear anymore.
So we would like to talk about your experience working in the field of activism and media, working with new technologies and also not so new technologies like radio. You do this particularly as a woman and for communities and groups of people who are not necessarily heard in mainstream media.
As you told us, you were really active in Budapest in the beginning of the internet. You even programmed the first Hungarian website, you told us.
One of ten.
And you co-founded the FACES mailing list, a network for gender, art and technology. How come you decide to somehow shift to radio after having worked with maybe newer technologies?
I think we always said wireless since 1917, which was funny because... like in Berlin, when I just pointed out the guy, Torsten, he started this bar called Automaten Bar, which had the first Wi-Fi. Mm. And that was actually just at the same time we started Rebirth. Mm. So, of course, wireless was in the air. And then wireless is a kind of another kind of metaphor. And so I like the way you presented me and the context, because there's something funny to think of radio in terms of space, like 90s cyberspace. Mm-hmm. And I was very active in building up alternative spaces within that. And then, like, within Budapest, but, like, around East and West Europe, mm-hmm. also trying to connect with other, like, spaces and other groups. So creating a space within the internets to have, like, I don't know, our interesting political island bubbles. Mm-hmm. So, and the radio became a way to localize, because I think the 90s were so intense. Again, like space, workspace in Documenta 10. And that was something that was mostly organized by Pitt Schultz and Herr Loving. They are sort of the fathers of net time. And I'm the, like, whatever, the woman. I was just there. Like, yeah. So I was a big part of that. And I was so busy with those, that culture. And then, we started to think that it would be better to sort of localize. And then I moved from Budapest to Berlin in that time. And it was like, okay, how to reclaim a physical space? So that was the first thing. Mm-hmm. And creating another workspace. And like this, one thing was the success and not success of a certain type of culture. And that culminated in this hybrid workspace at Documenta. So then to get real, and I think there was a notion that we had our kind of online tribe. So all these people from everywhere meeting in wherever, but never being anywhere specific. Mm-hmm. And that's, so that's the thing that was getting... boring, and then people that were really invested in their local scenes stopped being invested in their local scenes because they were so busy being in other places. So, and then it was like, so already in the late 90s, Berlin, we started to try to do more things based here and connect those two networks, like social networks here, but also the broader networks. So that started to slowly turn into a radio practice. And then I really have to say that, like, Pitt Schultz and Guido Pronsky, who are the other founders of Reboot, were doing club radio. So we started experimenting with what they were doing with broadcasting clubs, like taking club music onto the internet with streams. And then all of these different things. We had a space called Bootlab, which was a shared, like a, now it's called something like a hacker space. Mm-hmm. But it was already, like, we called it Independent Media Lab. That's what everyone called them then, not just us. And it was already really interdisciplinary. So a lot of, like, Natasha Sadir-Hajian was there. Like, also, she was one of the founders of that. So we were a space where a lot of different things came together. So graphic designers, filmmakers, artists. We had a quite good event space and a big empty room that was the first Reboot FM studio, which was like four times as big as this space. Plus next to it, a room where we could have concerts and parties. And then behind that, a gigantic workspace where we all had like different social and working constellations. So, and then basically even the space was already something that people would use for events. So we had all these kind of hackers, which is a very white male scene. So that was getting sort of colliding with different scenes. Like Kanakatak would use the space for rehearsals. Or, for example, Grada Kilomba organized some events with basically sort of Afro-German and black writers living in Berlin, which was also amazing because I think for a lot of the white colleagues, so white men, and especially like white, okay, they were mostly white men, to be honest, that were in the space. It was like the first time they were ever the only white people in a room full of black people, and especially black people that didn't need their help. So this was something that was really, I mean, that was really a kind of unique thing because I think everybody, of course, they, without it being tense, like they were a little bit like, oh, can we go in? Of course, it's a public event. But it was also like not being, encountering difference in a different way. It was more like encountering similarities, and then it was just a really nice event. But all of these different things sort of fed into this culture, and we found that the radio would be a good place to amplify all of that. Mm-hmm. And so this was like out of this space we were able to bring together a bunch of different scenes that exist and coexist in Berlin but might not necessarily overlap. And so Seda Gorsis was also part of like the scene around Ishwaria, which also brought in Orient Taxi, and we still work with until today. So, like, these are the things, and so that we had all of these, like, weird overlapping scenes that were able to then, like, be the basis of what could become the radio, and those were the different groups we were already in contact with. So asking, like, people what it would take for them to listen to the radio and what it would take for them to participate in the radio. Mm-hmm. And so we did a lot of that before we started making the radio. And so this was something that's basically the structure that Reboot FM still operates with. Mm-hmm. And it's built out of that, like, that social fabric was really loose, but we knit it together, and I think it's still a loose weave, but it works really well. And then we always had this idea that it was a reflection of space, and that it was a way to create a shared space in Berlin, and like that exists in a real sense in the airwaves, and it, you know, it really does. I mean, as the voices travel or the music travels through the air over the FM frequencies, there is an actual electronic signal that's pulsating through the air that gets, it finally reaches your ears, the receiver. So the senders and the, you know, whatever initiates the sound, and the receiver is finally the ear of the person, and that these shared moments that everybody could have together. So,
But, and so you couldn't use like another internet technology that you had previously used for this. Like, you found that radio was like the appropriate means to that goal that you just formulated.
Okay, this was the interesting thing, is that because we were so experienced with the internet, we also built a really good like open source software. We were one of the first radios to do streaming at the same time and to use what are now called podcasts. So inviting people to send us an MP3 file or other formats, we had a thing that tested them automatically. And so we were asking people not for one song, but for a 1 hour show. And so for us, I think one of the things was exactly to go out of already being in contact with the people you know. Because even, I think it's way stronger today, it's already the sort of bubble factor that you can connect all of these people through the internet, but creating this shared space is something else. And I think this is what social media tries to do, but we really, I think we wanted to burst our own bubbles in a productive way.
Mm-hmm.
So, like these social bubbles, and then radio is way more effective. And I mean, a lot of people didn't even have radio. I mean, this is 2003 and 4 when we were doing this work. People said they didn't even have radios at home anymore.
Yeah,
so they got radios, like, or listened on the internet. But some people were like, oh, I have to buy a radio now. And it's also this ability that with radio, you reach people you didn't know and that you will never know. So, like, you will never, like, we reach more people that we, you know, they don't call German, and especially Germans don't do call-in shows. Statistically in the world compared to everyone else, like, even if you have prizes, they don't call. It's an audience that doesn't give a lot of feedback. We do get feedback, but for every feedback we get, we know there are other people listening that just, like, I'm happy. We don't need them to do anything. So just enjoy.
Okay, so you're saying it was basically the most important thing for you was to put this multiplicity of voices out there, and have it,
yes,
recognized by people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the talk that we had before, you said that Reboot FM is not simply a free radio station. Like, it's different from other pirate stations, for example. And one of the differences is that it's edited. So it's not that everyone can send in their podcasts or their MP3s, but you kind of curate a bit what the content will be.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a bit about who are the groups that are currently maybe using your platform and to broadcast their shows? And what does the curation process look like, just so that we get an idea?
Okay, yeah, I would say, like, we say Free Artist Radio, Freies Künstlerradio, and that's really to mark a distinction with the traditional German free radio, which is often very much organized in a basic democratic way. And that was one of the things that when we started, which people asked us not to do, which meant, you know, that everyone should run the radio all together. And that if you make a show, you also have to be one of the studio technicians. We found it was like many people rejected that model. And when we had meetings that worked along that model, it was really nearly all white men. And they were really like, even if someone else that was not a white man showed up, it was very difficult for them to have a voice within that space, within that meeting space, and within that culture of meeting space, of a plenum. So, I mean, right now, what I like is that, for example, we have, I think I would go with like Steve Morrell, through him, or somebody like DJ Officer. They're sort of people that we started working with very early on. Over the years, they've had a guest or someone will take up a show. So that's like, so Steve Morrell still does the Zero Hour. He's still a figure in the like electropunk sort of scene. So he's very big there and he still DJs and he does a lot of music, but he's also got a second life as a fashion model, which is just interesting, I think. There will be a group like The Voices. They work for refugee rights. They were partly a group that was coming into Voices Caravan, have been doing refugee rights in Germany, like nationwide, since I think 24 years. It's a like organized group that fights for refugee rights and empowerment, but also to give access to refugees for information that they would need. And we met that group, and then we did some workshops just around open source software in Berlin and stayed in contact. It took about, we didn't do anything on the radio with The Voices until 2009. And now The Voices is doing a really regular show that's often broadcast on other radios as well. So it's called The Voices. And that's an activist group. And it's amazing because they've just gotten so good. And so, for example, one of the women who does the show, she's part of The Voices. She also then branched out with other colleagues and they do an intersectional feminist show, which is called Talking Feminisms. And so, like, so there's a kind of, it's a little bit organic. Sometimes we don't have a lot of people that do more than one show, but it's a very different group and it's a different orientation. Or then, like, which I love, the Young Communists who do Make Capitalism History. They came out of the student movement and they were organizing a conference called Make Capitalism History in 2009. And they invited us to present at their conference, but it was just as we were launching another radio, like it was exactly on the same dates that we were launching Herbstradio. But we met because they had invited so many of our friends, both locally and internationally. So like artists, activists, and we were like, oh, we have to meet. So they became radio makers with us.
It doesn't really sound like you have a lot of curation process. It's more like the you said it's organically growing.
Mm. Yeah.
It's like a referral kind of structure, like snowball. Or,
but it's still, I think, it is still selected. So it's like, it's more organic because that's what I mean, the social fabric is there. And I think it's built upon, like the fabrics that were built meant that we're popular enough, like we're like poppy enough, that we are appealing to the Krakuan, like the Chutin Krakuan and Kofaram. Like they also, you know, do a show and that came through another show. Like we are cool enough for them. We are political enough for the young communists. We are open enough for like lots of different types of experimentation. But mainly it comes through suggestions. And like we get very few requests from random people. We have a few now and it's like we do our best to sort of balance out the airtime we have with what we have. I think we've always tried to keep it to groups and artists that are active and have a following in Berlin. I mean, there's a guideline. We have a sort of guideline and we try to meet that. And then we also can allow some exceptions. So, it's so curated, it's selected, but it's also nurtured. And like, we are so well grounded within different communities that I think for us, it's more like sometimes we'll reach out to find, we try to take a step back from the program and look at what's missing, like what's going on in the city and what's missing from the program.
Referred to a movie, Born in Flames, and we've been watching it.
Great
movie. And I think what is interesting in this movie is also that you have different kind of communities, let's say like black feminists, white feminists, and independent radio, and you see this kind of common cause that brings those people, or these women, I would say, together to do radio and to use those media in order to get their voices heard. We saw some parallels, or like when we watched it, we were like, ah, yeah, makes sense. But maybe there was a project we would like to talk about is the Koti FM.
Mm-hmm.
Was actually quite interesting because you've been broadcasting it from there. And Koti has really become a symbol for local resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So can you maybe tell us a bit how it started and how your collaboration looked like?
Yeah, basically we had a 1 month temporary broadcast license. So we were on air 24/7 for 1 month. And that's something you can do that in Berlin. You can rent an event frequency. Anyone can do that.
Yeah.
And then you have to keep a signal on the whole time. And basically, that's something that Pitt Schultz and Sarah Lane, who was also used to be at Interflux, so, and she did another, she did her final project, Utica. She built a radio. And so we sort of supported her with that. And then she and Pitt Schultz came up with the concept for Koti FM. I think I did more of the outreach and then like bringing Koti Shop, bringing in partners like Koti & Co., who we already worked with. We Are Born Free, which came out of the Oranienplatz movement.
Mm-hmm.
It was fantastic because basically the transmitter was actually in the building where Koti Shop is, this small venue in Kreuzberg, just off of Koti. And we talked with a lot of people directly involved there, and we had a lot of different inputs. And Sarah was like, West Germany was important. So it was like, Koti & Co. very important, Südblock very important, and then Itoria very important.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like this kind of weird sort of branching out from Cottbus Atoll, and it was just 1 month, but it was really, you could hear it. I went one day to Tegel, and I could hear it all the way in the taxi.
Mm-hmm.
So this was something which it was cool. We did a lot of things with Ballhaus Neue Straße, so it was really like we got in all kinds of people to come and make shows. And I think, like, for example, a lot of kids were around that came by, and I think it's like, it built up friendships, but connections. And again, it was like this very, very strong materialization in the ether of real life relationships and exchanges. I mean, there were lots of really like just little interviews with bakers and all kinds of things. And this was, I think that was, it was really fun. And until today I see Koti FM stickers. They were really nice stickers, like silver and red, and the Atlantic, which was one of the refugee ships that had problems in the Mediterranean. had a Cartier, has a Cartier FM sticker on in their cabin. So we're like, oh wow, how did it get there? So
yeah, it's really interesting to hear how the real life resonates in media spaces, and how you don't separate those.
Mm-hmm.
The networks you build are here to bring people in real life together, and vice versa, right? Yeah, we'd be interested in this media space, cyberspace,
mm-hmm.
you could also say in the connection to real life. We have found a quote where someone said that you had worked with social media before that term even existed,
mm-hmm.
through your, I guess, mailing list and mm-hmm. bringing people together in like digital forms. So maybe you can tell us something about what was the social aspect of media back then in the 90s when you started using mm-hmm. new technologies, and how has the use changed now? Well, how would you describe the situation now?
I mean, that's interesting because like I can program, I'm terrible. But like when I was making websites, it was also just experimenting in the early 90s, like with Mosaic and, you know, Netscape, and it was really easier and harder. So like I had to use IRIX, which is like Unix, which for computer people can be impressive. Like, oh, you know, it's all command line stuff. I could enter commands and get a browser. I could make the computer do things. I was not very good, but it was fun then. I think once you get into that, you also see how, like, once you start working on this level of line command, which is basically how you can tell, how you tell computers what to do, you start to see how much social structures are embedded in the code.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something, and how much the social thinking gets embedded in what the computer can imagine, like what a person can imagine the computer can do,
mm-hmm.
how socially informed that is, and how socially specific that is. So that was one of the things that I could get into touch with, like through Faces. We did a project called Zero. I think we tried to use a Corbusier quote, actually, which is starting again from zero. And that was like, but that was just more or less an experiment to work with like the space of MUDs and MOODs, but to get in touch with this line command thing. And also because you really see how, but the terminology is so socially coded,
mm-hmm.
and that the ways that people think, you can see it in the actual code. I mean, sometimes it gets cleaned up. I've worked with Professor Dr. Heidi Schellhofer, who's in Bremen, because she's one of the, I think, most important thinkers in terms of like co-construction of knowledge and feminist software engineering, feminist software design. And that's where you start to, that's where I would say the social software, the social should happen before you plan the software. Once we started to come together, happy times 90s, and then start to see the disparities between who can speak, who can code, who can speak about coding, and then start to see how culture plays a role in these things that are, until today, like controversially understood as objective. And
mm-hmm.
so now we all kind of are familiar with the term of algorithms and so on, but that somebody wants the algorithms to collect the data that they collect, and the questions they ask inform what the machines can do. So it's like what we can imagine the machines to do. So of course for us it was one thing, like Faces, using the media itself to create social spaces and to create an exchange, using it as well to deconstruct what those things were. So the actual technology, even in a kind of Friedrich Kittler way, to be aware of the hardware, but this relationship between that, the sort of more vaporware, the hardware, and then what are the results? So like, you know what I mean? Because there's the hardware, there's the software, but there's what you do with it, and then there's how that's perceived. So all of these different layers of how media is produced and understood, and how through all of these different lenses of media. And so an understanding how each of these layers has its own complicated relationship with society or with social, like with its social, it's still socially read and informed.
Is any of that still existent in how we use the term social media today, do you think?
I think so, but you would kind of have to go into very sort of, I think, quite specialized discourses around media, how people perceive things and what they mean. Like Wendy Chun, I think, is doing some work around this. She's an American scholar that's now leading an institute in Canada, and she's just an amazing person, like thinker. one of the things is to like basically look at algorithmic society and how that basically informs what we can imagine out of the technologies. If you look at what Cambridge Analytica did, that's where you start to see how much even like these sort of innocent spaces of Twitter or these, you know, whatever self-expression spaces, how much they've been manipulated and how deeply well-researched that the manipulation was.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something where I think, so there's some more popular awareness of what these social media spaces are, like understanding them as more conflicted and more defined by outside interest. So it's not about just people collecting your interest in advertising, what shoes you like or hair products, but that they're also gathering information that can be used. And I see this is, I hope, a tendency to understand like that these social softwares are coming out of something that is a motivation behind them. Mm-hmm.
There are lots of different ways of putting social life into softwares somehow, in the digital world. There's always this notion of like gaming culture, which is like completely male dominated, and still, might be one of the causes why women were kind of pushed out of technology, or like one hypothesis, and they rely on avatars. So why you're a different person and it's totally disconnected from your life. You have this avatar in this digital world. What is the feminist version of using cyberspace? Is that like, how would you describe that? When you maybe say what constitutes cyberfeminism, or like, what's the quality of that space when you use it in the feminist way?
Well, that's very interesting that you bring this up, because for example, in this like Mud and Moose space, which was really text-based. It was before there was so many graphic interfaces, and that was more line commands where you would, you know, define spaces. And there, I think that's where people had this sort of like avatar existence that was where they would, you know, I can be an octopus, a purple octopus, whatever, gender-free, where you, for example, had like this, like an online rape where someone, you know, there were all of these things where people could have a totally counter, contrary, parallel existence somewhere on the internet, like in these like chat rooms or in dungeon, like the multi-user dungeons. That was something. VNS Matrix, the Australian cyberfeminist collective that's coined the term cyberfeminism after Donna Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto. Like I met them in '93 on the internet. But I was, '94, I was already too late for that Mud and Moose space to be interesting. It was more like the octopus was in the corner talking about taxes to somebody. Like, they're, like, you would, because once you get in, you can read the description, so you see and you can hear what conversations are public. You can see, you can read it, basically. But it was like, I tried to have this sort of interesting offline experience, interesting online experience, but I was too late. So, but I was curious about it. But the thing is, in spite of this possibility to be something else, it was mostly white men performing this in this space. Maybe that's what's interesting, is that's where cyberspace got this idea of being a liberational space, is because it had this base, and it had that, a lot of people had that experience, but it was still mostly white Western men. Of course, there are like pockets around the world where it was different, but mostly coming out of California, you know, and that's why you get California ideologies. So like VNS Matrix, when they talk about Big Daddy Mainframe, they already came with a feminist critique of not just that moment, but what that moment could mean. And I think, for example, Big Daddy Mainframe is still, I think, like now, I think more, a lot of people have heard this, and they might not have any idea that it refers to the VNS, like the Cyberfeminist Manifesto. It's a good operational metaphor, that it's something you can imagine what that means, and it doesn't sound good. I mean, for the cyberfeminism in the 90s, I think in a lot of ways that was failed, mostly because it was taken up too much in Europe by just artists, and there was too much hype, so that it never had a chance to develop into being something. For example, Hybrid Workspace was basically where the Old Boys Network, they were invited to do a cyberfeminist project. I mean, like Connie Solfrank was one of the people, Vali Georgievich, who's one of the founders of Faces, was also one of the OBN founders. They were invited by basically Hert Lovink to do a cyberfeminist project. And he was sort of, oh, you guys have to read the Cyberfeminist Manifesto and Donna Haraway. And it's sort of really funny, like, there was a need for something more edgy than Faces to fill up a space within this male culture, even at hybrid workspace. And it's like, it's, I think there's a really nice article on Rezone where Cornelia explains this to Florian Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, but I think, you know, like, like this, how that came about. And then it got really popular, but it didn't do anything. So this has been my problem, is it was hard to connect it with a practice.
Yeah.
And I think, like it's different. North Americans, Canadians, like U.S. Americans and Mexicans tended to use the term cyber feminist to describe women's, like feminist activists going on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I was following this a lot for a couple of years to sort of see that they embraced the term, but what they were describing was actually much more activists using the internet. And that's, like, so the term, it sounded really good, and it was appealing to young women that didn't like feminism. And I'm more keen on the term techno-feminist now. And this is what I'm looking at, is what kinds of practices. I mean, this is what I'm actually starting to look into, is what would that mean, because we need it now. And so, like, what does it mean now to sort of, like, look after Gamergate when women criticized online behavior towards women, and then, critiques of gaming and how you get trolled and really violently and aggressively trolled. They're quite, like, I think it's a mainstream problem now that, that sort of problems on the internet in terms of gender are, it's a very mainstream discussion. But I still think, like, popularizing something like feminist coding, like best practices, best questions, I still think there are some people that operate like that, but I think they're still few and far between. And like, for example, I will say that Reboot FM has a feminist model, but it's not a feminist project. Or it's a feminist, you know, without, it's not a feminist radio, but it has a feminist structure. And I think Wendy Chan is looking at this. She would not describe it like this, but looking at what we can do with the algorithms, what are the ways, how can we use the algorithms for feminist ends? Use this, like, we can all use the data, the same types of data Cambridge Analytica collects. It's just ask it different questions.
How do you define feminist when you use it this way? Like, I wonder.
Okay.
Because, like, yeah, what's the feminist quality about it?
This,
what makes it feminist?
Yeah, well, all you have to do is watch Born in Flames. No. I would go with, it's a radical rethinking of how we, like, address the conditions in which we live, understanding that through the lens of, like, race, class, and gender, and how those things intersect, and then understanding how that could inform media. And so, for example, like, in Born in Flames, you have all of these different types of media, and you see them being produced, getting discussed, you know, the state magazine, the radio shows, how those things are then amplified. You see people watching, people producing. So this is something like taking those questions on board. Let's say I want to build a robot, okay? I want to build a bot on the internet. What should this bot do? For one thing, I would talk to different groups, perhaps Heart of Code, the feminist hackerspace in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
I would ask them, what do you think? I would reach out to people that I think are asking questions, ask them what they think, and through that find other people asking questions, and then start to model that. Would we need one? What should it do? Who would use it? Ask people that I think would use this robot. Like, could you use a feminist robot? What if we had an army of feminist bots? This is
the women's army.
Yes. And for example, that if you could sort of subscribe to a service where if you're getting trolled, that you could have robots show up and help, you know, like anti-troll robots. And that basically, like, what would be the signal, like the whistle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and this is something, so like looking, and basically one thing is creating a space where people could imagine, I can do that. If I need a feminist robot, I can get one. Like, if I need my feminist army bots, like,
mm-hmm.
Okay, let's do this. So first of all, it's having, like, the imagination to do it. So for me, a feminist project would be to build the space where it's possible to think about it,
mm-hmm.
and then get together the people and the resources to make it happen, but to ask a bunch of people questions. Because this is, for me, this is the most important thing, is creating a space where there's not so much a user or developer, but a space where a bunch of different interests can collide productively, and out of that you produce something. Feminist software design, I think that's one of the things, is this attempt to collapse the relationship between user and developer. Like, even in open source circles, the programmers will often call the user losers, and there's still this totally strong dichotomy between who programs and who uses. And I don't think that's radical enough of a shift away from the dichotomy between the commercial, like commercially produced softwares or proprietary softwares, where there's a commercial firm producer and a customer. It would mean exactly to create a culture of software production that allows for this other model, which is where you don't have users and developers, that you understand users as developers. The things that somebody might need are built into the process, but their role is built into the process. Mm-hmm.
Just maybe to explain real quick to the people who haven't watched the movie Born and Famous. I think it's fictional. It's like 10 years after the socialist revolution in the US, which is like something that is unimaginable if you've ever touched ground in the US.
Yes. Especially
today. It's a curse if someone says you're a socialist. Also, one of the scenarios is that the woman army is basically a gang of women that teams up and they run around. If someone is in need of help, they come with the bicycles and they basically, they are a gang.
Mm-hmm.
They protect each other.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's called Girl Gang in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bike gang that goes around doing this. They're anti-gentrification activists, I think mostly Chicanas. Mm-hmm. And they are, of course, I have to say it. It is some sort of real life implementation of Born in Flames. And this I love because that's what I mean. It's like to be able to produce that kind of liminal space where people can imagine doing something and then they do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's a feminist media because that film was never intended to provoke that many things.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I would say that we need that to happen within the space of technology. And within the social space of like neo-fascism,
mm-hmm.
and so this is where feminism is needed.
Probably for those who don't know what the faces mailing list was, I just cite it was a pragmatic response to the need of a small but growing number of women in media, initiated after a series of discussions that took place on the margins of European media arts and media culture events via emails in bars, with the question, "Where are women?" So. That wrap up a bit what we've been discussing.
It's still running, right? It's still, I don't know how many people are subscribed now. Where is it active?
I think I just looked and I think it's 450, which is the most it's ever had. Like I think there's always about another like double number that aren't on the list subscribed that are somehow in the family that show up at events or that are used to be on it but don't always resubscribe. It's not a cult. So, I mean, that is something I'm still for this simple response. It's something, I read, like, Shuli Cheng has organized something at Ars Electronica and it's, like, NetTime is a still far more important channel in terms of a discursive space. And it has something like 5,000 members now. Like, I'm not even on it. I still read it, but I don't...
Hmm.
It's not something I need to participate in. And I don't need it in my inbox. So it's more like a journal that I've, like, co-founded and, like, with Pitt and Herrick. I mean, Pitt and Herrick really ran that. That mailing list, that space was still useful. So it was, like, there were several different mailing lists at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So having one for women just seemed... It was such an easy thing to do. And it was, like, the easiest thing we could do based on what we had... Resource-wise, time-wise, you know, it didn't cost money to set that up, so it was something easy to do.
And it still helps you connect. Like you said, it's like basically also a couch surfing. It's like contact sharing. It has all these different layers of women supporting each other. Right?
Yeah, and I just recently met a couple of like really much younger women that are on the list, and they didn't like we just meet through first names, so we don't come up. But I just mentioned later on, like, oh, you're interested in these things. Well, I run this list, and like, oh, I'm on Face. Oh, you're Diana, and it was really interesting. It's like, wow, I didn't know. And it's like, I think it could be more, it could be more interesting, but it's just a mailing list, but it's still there. Meanwhile, NetTime has a huge crisis. They're like, only 50 people post, that's way more than we have posting, but it's like, well, you have 5,000. And they are having white men problems with social dynamics, and that is it outgrew itself. It became too successful. It became too much of a career springboard, which was very good and useful and necessary. But the pre-publishing channel, this kind of interesting space that it was with meetings and publications, like I'm talking about NetTime, which is a different mailing list, that had a time, but that was also very specific to the 90s and early 2000s. And that, like, in a way, I don't expect something to function in the same way. You know, and that's something that Faces, like, Faces is much weaker because of Facebook. A lot of people would have earlier discussed things on Faces, and now it goes over Facebook. Mm-hmm. So,
you have talked a lot about how you bring together people and create spaces for them, and that's really great. We would be interested in how you found the place, like, and how you found the people to work with and create your own thinking. We find there is a loose connection to the quote of, and we also have used as a starting point in some way for the podcast, or one of the influences, the quote by Virginia Woolf, or the idea, like, from the book A Room for One's Own, that every woman needs money and a room for her own, basically, see it a bit freely, if she is to be working creatively in a free way.
Mm-hmm.
Those benefits of, like, personal freedoms and having the resources to support yourself, that doesn't just apply to women, it basically applies to everyone, all kinds of different people. How did you manage to become who you are, and how did you find out how you wanted to work and with whom, and what spaces did you touch along the way? Who did you meet?
Is
this easy question? Like, you're originally from Albuquerque, New Mexico, right?
Yeah.
It's far away.
Yes, it's far away from everywhere. Well, I think for me, it was good to be raised in a really provincial space. You know, I'm 51, and it's like, I grew up, like, I don't like to say it because I like for people not to know. I don't care, but I don't care that much. I color my hair. So I went into the world in a moment of political, like, conflicts. And I don't, like, sometimes I was just thinking there was in 78, this march to Washington with a bunch of different tribes. I remember when that happened. And there were, like, I went to school in a small town in Farmington where there were a lot of, it's, like, on the edge of the reservation. So there were a lot of Navajo kids at my school that didn't live in the city but on the reservation. And so it was, like, there were bomb threats at my school in protest of different dam projects. So it's, like, there was Tierra Maria, there was armed conflict, almost a civil war in northern New Mexico. And, like, those things were part of my world. And it was, like, I think being just privileged enough and underprivileged enough, so to know that you want more, but you have something and there's something more to fight for.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I think, is, like, I would go with something like this. And growing up in a place where decency is normal, which I think means how poor people are with each other, because, like, until today, New Mexico is a really open-minded place. It's not tolerant, it's just decent. And there, it's like, if your car breaks down, people help you. There were some, you know, really heavy political struggles there when I was a child, so I didn't really understand what those were. But I think, yeah, like, my father was a criminal lawyer, quite, like, well-known criminal justice lawyer, and my mom was just a really nice lady that worked at the, like, unemployment office and got demoted, actually, when she shouldn't have. So she broke into the, she broke into the headquarters of Intel. She went in without an appointment and forced her way into the boss's office to convince him to give jobs to New Mexicans as a part of her job. Like, she just refused to leave. So when I say broke in, she did not. She just did that in a very legal, gentle, nice lady way. So, but those are things where, like, being convinced that a firm like that should actually have some decent, well-paid jobs for New Mexicans that aren't just janitors. Like, one of my neighbors was a janitor at Intel in Albuquerque. Like, that, and it was a really good job. So I think once you deal with a certain kind of poverty, and then if you have enough, like, a certain, like, a richness in imagination, then you can start to think differently. So this is something where I would, like, treasure mother, grandma, that, so it's go out and be in the world, and that I had the means to do that. But it's not about economy in that sense, because everybody could, like, I could work 3 jobs, save money, and come to Europe. But I also had the idea that I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my wealth, because that's not an idea that everyone in Albuquerque can have. Like, most people there, just, like, you can't even go to, like, no one wants to go to Texas, but, like, even to go to New York is already out of the realm of an imagination. And so that's when going to college, all of these things. So I think one thing is having been the good fortune to have enough, like, inputs that gave me an imagination that I could do something else and that I could be in the world and that I have a right to be in the world. So That's a very, like, and that's, I think, that being curious, a little bit angry, like angry that the world is not right, being curious, being open, and having a lot of good luck, and working very hard, and actually, like, being way too tolerant towards a very, very low economic existence, like, very poverty-stricken existence. But I do, yeah, so that's, so, I would change that. I would have been more, if I look at the years, all the different projects I've done and people I've worked with, I'm pretty much satisfied. Lots of mistakes, but the biggest mistake was undervaluing my own work economically, and that I should have always asked for more money. And every young woman should do that, or old woman, everyone. That's what I would say. So, mm-hmm. because that's one of the things I think that would be part of my army of robots. I hope they become bank robbers. So that's like making being more equitable with how we deal with like resources. In time, but also economically, making sure that we take care of ourselves in order to keep up the struggles and to keep our lives maintained and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hope that, because otherwise I would go on a million different trajectories and stories, and I don't know, like...
Yeah, that's a good answer.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the talk.
Thank you.
So, I want to make a small blurb, because I should be kind of correct about the radio. Reboot FM broadcasts on 88.4 in Berlin and 90.7 in Potsdam. Mm. We do this with a license that we've been fighting for since almost 2004. So the city has allowed for a free artist license. It's just Friday, Saturday, Sundays. And we have the partners Kashmir Radio, We Are Born Free Empowerment Radio, Savvy Funk, BLN FM, and Mobile Radio. And we operate through a new foundation called the Radio Network Berlin. And this, I think, is very important because that's like without this constellation, none of it would work. But it's also wonderful to see that payoff. So it's only 3 days a week, but it's our own license. Mm-hmm. And I also have to say that the Reboot FM team is really fantastic. We have a unique situation at the moment that we actually have fewer women on the team running the radio than men. And that means we have an extra male person in the studio. So almost since 2009, Noemi Kairon has joined Tip Schultz and Guido Plonsky and myself running the radio. And she's basically our studio freak. That's how we, like her, that's her chosen term to describe her role as studio leader. So, and now Tor, and we have really had almost always more women running the radio. Elizabeth Enke, Salome Gersh, Winnie Simon. So it's really unique, like, oh, like, mm-hmm. we've got guys. Oh, guys can also work in the studio, don't you think? Yeah, I think he can learn the mixer. And, of course, yeah, András, like, we had a friend from Budapest, from Tilos Radio, has joined us. So we actually have, yeah, we are now, like, in the studio, more men than women. And that's really new. So,
mm-hmm.
And it's Noemi Kairon is still our studio leader. So.
And, yeah, we mentioned before very shortly that we are at Akut in Berlin, Mitte.
Yeah. Oh, yes,
which is this large... kind of non-commercially run.
I think it's one of the wonderful things that has been an independent space in Berlin. Mm-hmm. It's always got fantastic programs, and everyone should support it. And,
yeah. So how can we support it?
Come to the events. Check out what's going on here. Come down, have a drink. Go to the exhibitions. Come to see the concerts. Go to the cinema. Go see a theater.
This was the F Podcast, and we are the FM Art Collective.